Welcome to the Investor Mama Podcast, Money Conversations with a Mom's Touch. Your host, Jen Narciso, interviews amazing guests each week to help you become educated, be inspired by other money stories, and stay motivated on your own wealth-building journey. No matter where you are financially, whether you're in debt or financially free, this podcast is for you. Now sit back and enjoy.
Welcome back to the Investor Mama Podcast, Money Conversations with a Mom's Touch. I'm your host, Jen Narciso. And for those of you who listened to last week's episode, Community Corner, I went through some wins of the community. I answered some questions and talked about some topics that were of interest. If you have a thought or a question or anything or win, please go to investormama.com/connect. Join the Facebook group. Message me, message the group. I really want to hear from you. And on the next Mini Corner episode, which I'll release in a couple weeks, I'll share it. I'm super excited about this. I think it's a great opportunity for us to interact with one another, to engage, to really create a tribe. And so I'm super pumped about this. Again, go to investormama.com/connect and I want to hear from you. So on this week's episode, I have the pleasure of interviewing Dawn Casey Rowe. She is a mom and author of two books, which is pretty cool. They are A Broke Teacher's Guide to Success, How to Build Your Dreams on Teacher's Pay. And she also wrote Don't Sniff the Glue, A Teacher's Misadventures in Education Reform. So today's episode, I actually originally wanted to call it Even Teachers Can Reach Financial Independence. But I think there's a lot more to this episode, and it's really more about how to shift your mindset and shift gears and allow yourself to find your passion and explore new opportunities to create wealth and not be limited to what your current quote-unquote job profession is or whatever you're currently doing and currently working on. So even though Dawn shares her story about some of the mental blocks teachers face and how she was able to shift gears into other professions, really find her true value and find value in what her passions are and create wealth that way. The tips and the content that she provides is applicable to anyone who's looking to make a change in their life. So definitely listen up. I hope you enjoy it. Before we dive in, though, a quick word from one of our show partners. If you've listened to a few Investor Mama episodes, then you know I promoted the Facebook ad course created by Mike Yonda and Bobby Hoyt from Laptop Empires because I did it and it's so awesome. This course teaches you a great way to make an extra $1,000 to $2,000 a month helping businesses create and implement Facebook ads. With businesses rapidly moving online and charting unknown territory, now is the perfect time to learn ways to help them make a profit so you can create cash for yourself. Or if you have your own business, Facebook ads can help you generate a lot of solid leads. I am super excited to announce that if you go to investormama.com/make money, again, that's investormama.com/make money, all one word, and sign up for the Facebook ad course using the discount code FALL150, all capital letters. Again, that's FALL150, all capital letters. You will save $150 off the regular price. It's a steal. So go to investormama.com/make money to sign up. And don't forget to use the coupon code FALL150, all capital letters. Don't worry, I'll also put a link to this in the show notes as well. Doors close this Sunday, September 20th. That's this Sunday, September 20th. So don't miss out on this amazing opportunity to learn how to start a very profitable side hustle. Dawn, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Jen. Thanks for being an early morning person with me. It's amazing to find them.
No problem. I'm really excited to have you on today's episode. Before we go into the main topic, which is really helping teachers who typically are known to not create a ton of income, I know that's a stereotype and I'm totally projecting, but I'm really excited to help learn more about what some tips you would suggest. But before we go into the main topic, can you give me a little bit of background about you and how you got started and your path on the financial independence journey?
Sure. So I think, first of all, it's really important to say it's always a journey and hopefully we get there over time. But for me, I grew up in a family that was pretty financially conservative. My dad left, he was a banker, and he left the Treasury Department for a while when I was very, very little to go and start doing just good work. They started soup kitchens, houses for the handicapped, really worked with a lot of nonprofits. And as a little kid, I didn't really understand what that was, but it was about quality of life for him. He was traveling and on the road with the Treasury Department. And one day I didn't know who he was. Who's that man? And so they really, my parents wanted to restructure the quality of their life so that they could be there and they could do the things of value to them. But in the process, they were with some of these nonprofits. He went back into banking and all these things. They had ups and downs financially. So I always remember the sales, the struggles. And there were times when things were better later on. But when I was very little, I remember certain things really had an impact. And I think I took those things, those fiscal responsibility, or maybe frugal, or my friends sometimes say overly cheap things into my life. And that gets reinforced when you're a teacher. So all these experiences led to me being uniquely qualified to be overly cheap. And that can sometimes be a challenge to developing a mindset where you want to be financially successful. So that's something that I want to return to. But for me, my background was I went to upstate New York for college, University of Rochester, and I majored in something you can now do for about $250, which is a foreign language. I started being a music major, and it took me about 2 weeks to fail out, because apparently music majors, especially at the Eastman School, are super well-trained and amazing musicians, and I had three chords and a guitar, and I would write songs about people. So I did not cut it in the music industry, but I switched to something I loved, which was languages, and then went on from there. And so I lived in Moscow for a few months, and I came back and worked for an insurance company. So after about 10 years there, I said, I'm going to go teach. I actually saw a vision. There was I was sitting in my cube doing whatever it is that you do in your cube. And a light hit me from the sky. And I heard this voice, and it said, you have to leave and teach. And usually if you hear a voice, either you really need some assistance or you have to obey that voice. And there were no burning bushes. So I just started thinking about this, and I applied to grad school and went to teach and double ended and worked with the company and finished my grad school. So that's how I got into teaching.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. And so at this point in your life, how were you living? Were you saving a lot when you first started teaching? I know you said you've always been frugal, but if you don't mind me asking, what was your income and savings rate when you first got started?
When I first left college, now let's talk about student loans, because my student loans were, at the time, they seemed very high, but they were reasonable. And then when you graduate, you get to pay those things. So they were a couple hundred bucks a month to pay, which by today's standards is free. And then I had my first car, a little 89 Toyota Camry, a little old hoopty that I drove around. So I didn't have that many bills. But what happens is, being single and then you get your first little apartment and you do all these things, you learn to spend. So when I started working for the insurance company, it was a typically great graduation salary in corporate America. You don't know what you're going to do. You're not going to be a doctor or lawyer. So you're okay, well, I'll take this corporate job. And it was more than enough to survive. So I was saving a little, but probably not as much as I needed to. I was piling some money into my 401k, doing all those things. But later on, when I noticed why didn't I have as much money as I wanted to from my early career, it wasn't that I went out and partied and went to happy hours, because I'm a fairly lame human being in that regard. So it was...
Me too, don't worry.
Yeah, I'd go out and I'd do things and I'd have a grapefruit juice. I did my things, but I didn't save enough. And when I did, what I did save, I destroyed later on. So we can come back to that. But I didn't save enough because I finally had money for the first time in my life and I was paying my bills. And I was just so excited that at the end of the month, there was money left over. And I did a lot of gifting. So you're in your 20s and you have, everybody's getting married, they're having their kids, they're doing all these congratulatory things. And so you can do things, even though I didn't really drink, I could go on vacations, I could do these things. And so I was learning to spend a little bit more than I needed to if I wanted to shore up my finances. We're going out, we're giving, we're doing things and not really necessarily planning for what the next chapter would be, which for me turned out to be teaching. I remember my first year teaching was $28,000, and then a couple, $2,000-$3,000 or $4,000 for my master's.
So Dawn, you got a new job, you're starting to teach. At this point in your life, are you now starting to save more, or are you still of the giver mindset?
I was still giving, and this is going to follow me as almost a curse into my next career teaching. So I didn't really feel the need to save because all the bills were being paid. There was money going into retirement. When I started teaching, you know, that's an automatic. At the time, it was a pension plan. It changed in mid-career, but it was just taken care of. It was automated. Everything was being paid and there was a little left over. Now, as an older, responsible adult, I would have saved more. But at the time, I perceived that I was saving and meeting all my obligations and that I could be generous.
So now you're teaching, and I know a lot of our listeners out there are teachers as well. Love to take a minute now and go into your teaching story. I know typically that teachers usually have pay based on a scale level where you, if you get a higher degree, you may make a little bit more, and every year you get incremental raises, but you pretty much know what your pay grade's going to be. There's not like you can make huge jumps that if you made the next sale or you got a commission or extra income that way. So what's some of the strategies you've been using or that you would help guide other teachers who maybe feel a little trapped in what their income levels are?
This is actually an interesting question when you look at step pay and teacher pay and the way it's done historically. One of the things I realized teaching was I was teaching and we also had businesses on the side. So there was a whole lot of stuff going on that was not just teaching. The typical teacher might have their teacher paycheck and then maybe bartend or tutor or do these things to supplement their income. But when you're a teacher, what you're going to make literally for the rest of your life. I remember when I first got my job, I said, what's the match? And they looked at me and they said, what do you mean, what's the match? I said, for your 401k. And they just laughed me out of the office because in teaching, there's no matching. There's none of the things. At the time, there was a pension, which is way better than a 401k match anyway, but I didn't quite yet understand that. And we didn't pay anything for our healthcare. So that was the benefit. You were making much less money, in my case, half of what I made in corporate. And you got to go to the doctor and you got to do these things. And so that was what it was. But I've been looking at pay regionally because I didn't realize at the time I'm in New England and teacher pay in New England compared to teacher pay in many other spaces is exceptional. So for me, in the beginning, it was very low pay, but then over time, over the pay scales and steps, it was more than enough for a person with a family to live reasonably and not go crazy. But still, I was in debt for a while. And some of that, we had some business downturns, but I can directly trace tens of thousands, a lot of money of debt to the way I was approaching my teaching career.
Can you go into this a little more? Because I always thought teachers didn't have a lot of money because their salaries were so low, but that doesn't seem to be the case in your situation.
So the problem with teacher pay was only regional. You'd figure, well, teachers in North Carolina or Oklahoma, you know, challenged areas where they're really not historically paid well, they'd be struggling, but people in New England would all be fine, right? But I was also not fine. And so to me, I started to realize that there was something else going on. And at the time, I didn't know what. A few years later, I started working in tech and I realized I knew what it was. It was clearly the mindset, because what was happening was teachers would go in and they would spend a great percentage of their paycheck on their job. And you could say that police officers do this or nurses do this, or there are other service careers where people are big givers and they'll help out the community. But in general, you work because you need to get a paycheck and then you take that paycheck and you save and you pay your bills or you set some goals and achieve them, right? And so in teaching, you juggle your grocery bill or cut out something you need because you just spent that money on the back to school sales. And it's all pervasive. And so when I started to realize that this was a trend and a mindset and it's not sustainable, it was, to me, I never would have realized that. I would have continued doing this for a million year career, but we had business downturns. And at one point, my husband lost his salary with the business. I just had my son and he lost that. And we were trying to fund the business, do all these things outside. We went from two salaries to one and it was not yet high enough. I was mid-range teacher step and I couldn't meet all the obligations on my own. And in the background, I didn't know exactly what was happening, but I now know it was the market crash. It was 2007, right before the big crash. And weird things were happening. I got a letter saying, hey, thanks for being a loyal credit card customer, and we just doubled your rates. And I thought, well, no one doubles my rates. I have exceptional credit. And all these flags were happening. And I said, I'm just going to cut debt now. And that's when I started getting a little bit overly zealously frugal. And I now see that that saved us at the time. But it also put some things in motion where I became uber cheap. At the time, I sold my car. I got a less expensive car. There was no more restaurants. We just battened down those hatches. I learned to cook. I had always grown up canning and baking and things, but I did it like a mad woman. And I started couponing, all these crazy, insane, extremist things.
How much debt did you have at this point?
I remember my husband had to negotiate out of some business debt at the time in 2008 with that crash and bubble. I paid mine, but and I paid off some of that other debt. But I remember my credit card was probably up to about 14,000, which in the grand scheme of things is not huge. But when you're, you know, 20 something, you're just married, you're doing all these things. I was too old to have that much superfluous debt, but it was a warning sign. And I went without credit. I said, fine, I thank you very much. I do not accept your doubling the interest rates. And I cut up the cards.
A lot of people can't do that. How did you get the mindset to physically do that?
Well, if you ran the numbers, I was definitely overpaying my cards. I never have paid the minimum, but I was overpaying them, making some headway, overpaying my student loans. So I was always an up rounder. I rounded all my bills and debt up so I could pay it down faster. But yet I had incurred this debt on the side. And one thing I had done when I started teaching a few years in was I rolled my 401k into a debt repayment. So I paid down some student loans, and it was my first one from leaving my first career. I cashed it out, and that's just, it's stupid, right? And now I could, you know, smack myself in the head for that. But at the time it seemed reasonable because I had these student loans, I had all these things, and I was leaving that career anyway. So I didn't make a good financial decision.
Why would you say that? Because I know people who have actually done that. So I'm curious your perspective. Would you say that wasn't a good decision to take your 401k and pay off debt?
Because if you looked at the cost of the debt versus the future value of the 401k, especially given the fact that you're taking a significant tax hit to take the money out of that, it's just not a good decision. The value of that money today would have been huge, but it's gone because you took it at the cash value and you took the hit on the penalties for what? For spending on a credit card? It just wasn't worth it. It wasn't the right decision, I don't think. Actually, somebody who speaks really well on this is Ramit Sethi's book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich.
Yes, yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, it is. It's actually, I used to use that when I was teaching. I would give it to kids, and it was one of the only books they read, and then they stole. And it, not only would they read it, but it would end up with another kid who would say, oh, miss, I got this book from somebody who got it from somebody. So it circulated.
I'll put that in the show notes, though, for people to check out.
Oh, it's amazing. But what's good about that book is it really automates the process of going through and doing that. Now, I wish I had read that 2 minutes before I liquidated my 401k in my 20s and did all these things, but still, it's not a good decision. The decision is you commit to your savings and you commit to your investments in retirement, and then you leave it there. You let it do what it does. So again, so that ended up being a space where I had to rebuild. And I did over time, we did, but teaching, I was still spending. I remember getting a stipend for a decent amount of money, but I spent twice as much buying the kids junk food and snacks and helping them out and buying pencils. So it's not the solution. Teachers will go in there. And when I started realizing, well, you can't do that, that was because of that crisis, I put a no spend policy in my classroom. And when you do that as a teacher, two things happen. One, you stop spending. So that's a positive, a good thing. But two, you immediately become greedy because no teacher doesn't spend on their classroom, right? And I've had this argument in public spheres because I write and I'm out there and I speak. And people say things, well, if you aren't willing to give a kid a pencil, you shouldn't be teaching. And I will say something back, well, geez, I'm wondering if you've considered that I've had anywhere from 180 students a year to 256 at a high, every one of whom seems to need a pencil, right?
I think this mindset comes from that as a teacher, you're just expected to subsidize some of your students' needs.
I think it's the type of people who become teachers quite often. I mean, if you look at people who become teachers, no one goes into teaching because it's a high paid career, a career with a lot of us. If you look at the strikes across America now, or you look at teacher pay scale versus corporate pay scale, or even now that I'm doing other things as well, when I was working both in education and had started working in tech, if I wrote an article for something for tech, for marketing or something, I could be expected to be paid a lot of money. In teaching, it would be 1/10. If I wrote something. And so just the expectation, and teachers help out. If I did an equivalent task in another space, we would call it consulting, and you'd write me a check for 20 grand. And I'm not exaggerating because I've seen it. I've seen the difference with my friends in tech doing things exactly the same I was doing in teaching, making a couple $100 or getting a high five and a coffee card. Thanks for hooking us up, right? And in tech, they'd send you an invoice and you'd be expected to pay. And nobody looked at you negatively. And that's been one of my biggest challenges. I work with somebody now who says, get over it. You got to be okay with this stuff. But in the teaching space, you can't. You're always apologizing for money. Oh, I'm sorry. My rates are this, but I can give you a discount or I can help you out. So if you would come to me with a request in my area of expertise, I'd say, sure, let me help. And so that's the mindset that you get into because you're always jumping to help.
For someone out there who's listening, who's maybe younger and just starting off in teaching and has the same mindset of you that there are tons of student loan debt, or their new mom, and they don't want to spend a ton of money in their class, how could they do this no spend policy? What would some strategies or tips be for them that they're not seen as the outcast?
This is a very tough thing, and I don't know that I ever really felt comfortable with it. But when I first started, I said, no. I said, I'm sorry. I would apologize. I'm sorry I can't, or I have a strict budget, or I'm working on some debt repayment. Or first of all, A, that's none of your business. I shouldn't have to tell you why. Yeah. I don't want to buy your fundraising thing. We had, for example, dress down days, and you had to pay for dress down days. And not only did you have to pay, but you had to put a little sticker on you. So if you didn't have a sticker and you didn't dress down, well, why aren't you dressing down? And there were some people who couldn't afford to. So it almost called you out like a sore thumb. If you did have the money and you just didn't choose to and you didn't have the sticker, well, maybe you weren't. Why? Why didn't you want to help out? So there was this feeling like you were constantly not doing enough. I tracked my spending for a week or two, and it was $250 that I was asked for. Wow. And everything
that's
from
just
prom
in one week.
It was a week or two. I remember that it was a very small amount of time. It was everything from tickets, and you'd buy the ticket and then go chaperone, or buy the ticket and then go to the prom, or if you went to the senior trip or the dinner or whatever, you still had to buy the ticket, or fundraisers, or hey, this student had a situation, can you help out? Or we'd be making the social studies basket. And some of that stuff wasn't very expensive. To contribute to the social studies basket is a few items out of my grocery cabinet, but still, it was the constant barrage of things adding up. I had to restock the pencils, or I had to buy the groceries, or kids needed this at a club after school. And you don't always feel like it's voluntary. You feel like you want to help and you want to give, but after a while, you're making financial decisions about whether you're going to pay this credit card bill at the minimum, or you're going to go and you're going to buy these things for school. And so that's something that happens over and over. A new teacher is not really able to take the firm stand a lot of times, because if you are not putting yourself in a good light, if you're not helpful, if you're not all of these things, you probably don't have job protections or tenure. Mm. So for me, being on the job for 10, 15 years, I could say, no, I'm sorry. And then I could drop the I'm sorry and say no, or I could say just no. But a little bit of a perception issue, like, oh, crazy Casey, she's the one who wore the same clothes for 2 years because she was creating a school uniform. So I created an image where I could carry that. And I was also mm-hmm. doing things outside of school and things. So I'm jumping around in the time periods a little bit, but at some point, I would make a decision to say, well, here's my budget. If I would normally give to church or to a cause or a charity or nonprofit, and I would normally give $50 a month, whether I could pay all my bills and save or not, if that's part of my personal value mindset, well, maybe now that charity is you. It's your class. And if you have to buy pencils, that's what you have to buy. Or for me, I mentally drew a line at my coffee. I needed coffee, and I would drink coffee if I was not teaching. Whatever, if I was any career, I would be drinking way too much coffee. So I put a Keurig together. I put creamers, a little syrup, and I would walk around and give coffee cups away. Hey, I haven't seen you in a while. I brought you a coffee. Or like people could come in and just take it. So that to me wasn't spending on my job. It was mental health and friendship. I'd buy you a coffee today, right now. So why could I not buy you one in that setting? So you have to make these decisions ahead of time and be disciplined about them, because if you're a teacher in a high paying district, you are just as struggling financially because you spend more and you give more and you do more. You
know? I think you're raising such an important topic though for teachers out there, especially teachers who are moms and have families and are all these expenses and obligations. And I feel that's something that we even as women deal with. We're always expected to give. We're always expected, even just not teachers, but in general, you're the daughter. There's typically a perception that you need to be the caregiver of your parents, or you need to be caregiver of your kids. And with all these roles and expectations, I think it's fantastic that you're highlighting this point that it's okay to say no, and it's okay to put your foot down. And then on top of that, not apologize for doing that.
And that's really key. And I think it's the mindset that we develop. And believe me, Jen, I'm not 100% there. We shut down the same businesses that were struggling in 2008. We shut them down this past year. So before, when we were talking earlier and you asked about financial independence, I had to chuckle because, yeah, I may have been there, but now we have a setback in the road and we're going to rebuild. But the key to doing these things is to realizing that you have the power and the value to do so. And as for most of my teaching career, I don't think that I believed in my value. I knew I was smart. I knew I was talented in my space, but I didn't believe you should really give me money for that. I just believed, yeah, I'll help you. And I realized that other people were not apologizing. And even the language, when I started working in tech in 2012, it was an accident. And I was working with somebody and I remember in doing some writing and doing things and he had just put out his first book. And it's just an amazing book. It's a great bestseller. And I was also writing. We reconnected over writing, my friend and I. And he said to me one day, I was doing some work for him. And he said, no, it doesn't work. That's bad. Redo it. And I was so crushed. I'm like, what do you mean? And what it was it's just a different way of communicating. And teachers, in education, we have block text and the email that's longer than Tolstoy. And you just did a perfect grammar. It's amazing stuff, right? And in tech, it's like, nope, didn't work. Sorry. Not even a sorry. It was never a sorry. It was a sentence fragment, one or two words. And to me, as a teacher, receiving those types of pieces of feedback, it was harsh. Nobody's honest in education. It's like, well, it would be great if you could do this. I think if you just tweak this a little bit, when the answer should be, it's bad. Here's why it didn't work. Do it again. And that's actually the best and most compassionate way of speaking and interacting, because in a business, if you say to somebody, that didn't work for me, you save them $100,000 because they didn't build out a product that nobody's going to use. In teaching, you just hurt my feelings. Well, and so as I was learning to deal in both worlds, I started to see a bit of a difference. And I started to notice where I wasn't being taken as seriously. And part of the reason I wasn't being taken as seriously was because I was helping and giving and doing, and people knew that I would be doing that all the time. So when I changed my vocabulary and I changed my way of speaking to, that doesn't work for me, or that's not in my bandwidth right now.
So to take a quick step back. So you're at a different point in your life now. You've been teaching for many years, and now you decide to start doing some freelance work?
I didn't really decide. It was a Shanghai. It was an accident, and really a great accident. I reconnected with a friend of mine from a long time ago. I noticed some of his material online, and he'd been an economics business guy. And I said, wow, you write really well. And so we reconnected over some writing. And at one point we were talking and I said something about technology, because I was very frustrated by education and technology and the fact that students would get their phones taken away and there was no internet, all these, just if there was internet, it was blocked and banned and you couldn't get onto it. It was just education technology. This was back in 2012. It struggles today. I mean, but we've come leaps and bounds since when I first realized that there was a special word for this ed tech. I just thought it was computers. And my friend was in the middle of Silicon Valley. And I didn't know about that, nor did I care, because I mean, I knew they had computers in California, but I mean, we didn't have heat in my classroom for years on and off. Wow. So I'm not about to zone in on computers and stuff. But it turns out that computers were not just computers. You had people building hardware and software and apps, and education technology was its own special space. So my friends were not in that space, the friends I was meeting and developing. And this particular friend said, well, there's a lot going on in ed tech. I'd be happy to introduce you to someone in that space. Now, I thought he was going to introduce me to a teacher or principal who didn't yell at you when your student took a picture of the notes on the board. That was my entire view of education, computers, and technology.
That's many's actually.
Yeah, it was just every time, like, no, you can't have that. They might do this or they might do that. It was a very big culture of no surrounding technology, and the infrastructure wasn't yet there. But I did have these kids that were like, since we didn't have computers, they wanted to take notes or they wanted to show a picture or do all these things. And so I said, sure. And the introduction that he made, it turned out that he showed me a friend's platform, which was like what a Pinterest is today, but it was called Learnist, and you could put all your material on these pin boards. And it wasn't necessarily intended for teachers, but I'd like, oh my God, if I can put all my stuff on these boards and then students could take it home and read it if they're vacationing, if they're not here, if they can't come, or just if they want to read it, I won't need to use a textbook. And this was a big deal, and I didn't have the vocabulary yet to talk about it. So the long and short end of the story was I took a couple calls with that company because, I'll help. And we had our business. It was a martial arts business. And in our business, if you wanted to build something or do something, if I wanted to put up a wall or finish an office, we'd all put pizza and beer out there and we'd all get there and we'd hammer up the wall. Your friends would do this for you. There was no such thing as funding or jobs or people getting paid for this. And so I said, well, yeah, you're a friend's friend. Let me help. This is a best thing I've ever seen. I sent an email to my friend. I said, oh my God, I have such old computer on my desk. It's the Columbus edition of Windows, Windows 1492. It's autographed by George Washington and Christopher Columbus. So I sent this email because it was such vision and I had never seen anything like it. I didn't even have the words for it yet. And my friend sent it to his friend, which again, that's a cultural difference. Like, and people share emails there and they share information. And in teaching, it's like, that's mine. That's my unit. That's my thing. We don't do that. So my email got to him and I ended up speaking with their product people and there, and then the CEO, a man named Farb Nivi, who's today building an amazing a cryptocurrency miner for regular people. But Farb was my first official founder. And I just... all I wanted to say was, oh my God, this was a great program and I love this platform, but you can't log on with Facebook. And because that's what they did. So I actually, what I was learning was product development. I was learning what types of things should an engineer put into a product or what's a feature? How do you sell this to a market? And I didn't know any of that. And it took me years to even figure out that this was a special space. I just said, oh my God, this is great. And I need to share it with every teacher. What if we tweeted about it? Or what if we did these things? And people would stop and look at me. They're like, okay. Like in the tech world, that was like, are you serious? Are you for real? And in the teaching world, we hadn't really seen this stuff. It was just starting to come out and crack open.
What year was this that you're talking about?
About 2012. And okay. And so in Rhode Island, around this time, I ended up, I discovered Twitter and teachers on Twitter and building a network online of remote people that you can connect with and all these things. I discovered an organization called Highlander Institute, which they found me and it was on a Twitter chat. And these were just revolutionary people who were starting to connect out. Their organization was helping to find adaptations for kids with needs, but then it's just national now. And it's a movement that's helping teachers personalize education and doing all these things. But
no, sorry, Kate, what is blended teaching?
Blended learning is basically you're just using educational technology in your classroom. So a lot of people think it's the next app, gadget, or tool, but it's not that. It's like, what's your objective? How do you want to teach and how do you use your available resources to do that? So for me, over time, I learned more about this. And because I didn't really have a budget for apps and iPads and gadgets, and we didn't all have computers in our classroom, for me, it was, how do I teach a kid how to use Evernote? Or we can collaborate on Google Docs or use Asana for project management. All these things I was learning on the tech side. Well, wait a minute, we could use this in education. For the Highlander Institute, what they did was they developed a group full of teachers who would go around called the Fuse Program, and they would just show best practices, or they teach people how to collect the proper data. Education is pretty infamous for driving people out with data, but this was data, like basically the equivalent of an A-B test. How do you know if what you're doing is working? Well, here's how we can collect that. So they just step by step really grew the influence in Rhode Island of educational technology until they were too big for Rhode Island, and they've really changed the landscape to Rhode Island as a space of innovation, and just expanded, I'd say definitely nationally, but it's a movement that is growing so rapidly and connecting with other spaces where education technology was important, like California and other spaces. But being in both worlds, I started to see, okay, some of these mindsets are not okay. I ended up being hired by a team as a contractor, and I got a chance to go out, see the office, go to an event, and working on the tech side of things versus the teaching side of things, it was 180 degrees different. I didn't expect to end up being hired by Learnest. I just got a few hours here and there and more and more and more. And the person I was working with, Crystal, went out on maternity leave. So I tried to do as much as I could of her stuff. And
you were actually getting paid at this point.
I
want to get paid. I'm a freelancer. Like the mindset for you.
I didn't know
the
that
teacher.
Word. No, I had no idea what freelancing was. I didn't know what the word was. It was just my friend who had connected us. His name is Kamal Ravikant. He's a great author. I'll have you put his books in your show notes.
Sure.
He knew that I didn't know about the tech world at all. And I think he was very deliberate in the types of people he introduced me to. And these people were just amazing human beings, great people. I didn't know what they were doing. I just knew that this was a product that I could use in the classroom, that it was amazing. And I think it took me a full 6 months to a year before I realized, wow, this is really significant. This is big. Before I knew I was in the middle of a space of innovation. Until then, prior to that, what I was just meeting people and saying, oh my God, I think that too. Or, oh wow, that's really cool. Because I was finding in education, it was just, I'd have an idea and no. Right? It was always no, or why we couldn't do something, or well, we can't do that because then everybody will want to do that. And I was always finding I was having these ideas. So this was a space, the Rhode Island people, the Highlander Institute and Sean Rubin and the people bringing these stuff out into the open in Rhode Island. And then the California people, like, oh my God, you guys just do these things and nobody tells you you can't. And then it's the opposite, build it and then release it. And you didn't need permission for anything. It was just a space of freedom that I loved. And I loved every single one that I worked with. I ended up working with a marketing team and I didn't know I was on a marketing team because I didn't really know what marketing was. Obviously, I'm fairly intelligent and I have a vocabulary. So I knew the word marketing, but I'd say things like, hey, this is a great idea. Why don't we just tweet it on Twitter or write an article? And that's content marketing. I didn't have a word for that. Freelancing, I didn't have a word for that. I knew what these people were, consulting. They just paid me.
So you literally stumbled. So you're teaching. Yeah. You have all these concepts that are more typically corporate-esque type language, a new vocabulary, and you're trying to navigate your own life, your own finances, but you still love teaching and you want to balance these worlds. And so for another mom out there or another person out there who is in a more feminine or female-dominated job or profession, because I know even myself, I work in a nonprofit, and it's the same kind of mentality, it's the same concept. You're just expected to give, you're expected to do, but there's all these actual skill sets that if you were to take some of what you're doing in these jobs, but then if you apply it into another sector or with another team, it's completely different, the perception of your value, your worth. And I just think it's really important to highlight that for people out there, even the stay-at-home mom who wants to use some of the skills that she's teaching with her children or building a family. These are organizational skills. These are all skills that you can then still make money off of if you just see it as a value. And it's almost like changing your mindset, your framework of how you think, of how you talk to yourself, but knowing that you're worthy and that you're a value and that all these things you're doing, you can grow, you can put yourself out there, because I think what you did is fantastic. You really almost built a whole other career for yourself in this quote-unquote box that you were in as a teacher.
Yeah, I can't give myself 100% credit for that in the beginning, because I think that if I intellectually knew what space I was stepping into, I would have been intimidated and I wouldn't have done that. So when I talk to people who say, well, I want to do that, they're step by step. So I now intentionally, you have to build, I started my blogs and I started writing because I love to write. And then I put them out there. And then years later, I'm like, that's a really ugly website. So I learned how to fix it a little bit. And it's never good, but they were always hobbies. So I didn't really go balls to the wall and say, I'm going to do that. But step by step, I started being around people who did do that. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I know just as much about X, Y, and Z. Well, why am I not capitalizing on that? And I think that's part of the journey. It's that almost giving mindset that still holds me down sometimes, that I have to consciously refresh my and reboot. And especially even this year, because again, when you come from a frugal background, you do it for one or two or three reasons. One, you could be frugal because you really believe in the environment and you shouldn't waste. And two, you might do it because you're a minimalist. I don't need this garbage on my desk and I feel good when I have this space-filled environment. But three is fear. And fear crosses the line in a lot of spaces. Like in teaching, you might always be afraid. It's evaluation season, it's high stakes. You don't have control over what you teach or do. So there's a lot of fear baked into the system. You might have fear over your income or your finances. But even the way we're taught to apologize and do. So I think for somebody just starting out to do this, I think, well, what are my skills? Or I don't believe I have any skills. So generally speaking, that's what people say. Well, I don't do anything. I'm just a teacher, or I'm just a whatever it is that I am, or I'm just a nonprofit or grant writer. Okay, so if you happen to write one grant for your nonprofit, people pay big money. That's a pitch. It's a proposal. If you're working for a consulting firm like Deloitte, they're not going to give you write a white paper for 50 grand, right? You don't write it for like, hey, thanks for doing that grant proposal. And so part of this is conscious research. You got to go out there and say, well, what is the skill? Well, my skill right now today is my writing, or I'm organizing. Even you organizing a kid's birthday party, that's project management. And you can't say, okay, well, baking a cake is like being a Cisco project manager. It's not. But what are the skill sets that you can develop and work with to expand that skill? And how do you take your first dollar? For me, as somebody who gives away so much, I start to do things like, hey, I have an idea. Well, how could I make that idea work? The other day, I saw somebody with a terrible website with a product I loved. And I said, hey, I love your product. Use it all the time. Bought from you a couple times. But the English isn't American English. I see all these problems. And your competition is doing this while your newsletter is breaking up and doing these things. Happy to do that. I'll discuss my rates. So it's been a habit. I have to start to learn to ask for that in my own value. Like, I'll work for anybody. I love working, love doing the things I do. I work full time in tech now, and I'm treated well. But if I wanted to grow outside of that, then I wanted to build another field or a vertical, what would I do? I do that. And another book, somebody who has done this very well is James Altucher. And James, years ago, when I first met James, he had a little blog and he was writing articles and things. And I just really liked the material. But eventually he wrote a book called Choose Yourself. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so familiar, because it's basically you could work for the man your whole life. But now the way that the economy is, it's changing. Like in my grandfather's time, everybody got a watch and retired and had one career. In my dad's time, it was, you might have a few jobs in your field, but you were staying basically in the same field. I'm sort of transitional. So I've had, I don't know, depending on what you counted, 3 or 4 careers.
Yeah.
And many jobs within them. I've been not teaching for 2 years, but my students will have 7 careers. And within that, many jobs, and they'll have to piece together these things, and they're not going to have affordable college and all these things. So the transition is very, very different, and it's very real. So what James was saying is out there, he's like, well, how do you do that? How do you build that? And you do that by choosing yourself and by getting out there and having your value speak for itself by learning, by asking for what you're worth, or even going out there giving value and then saying, okay, what can I do for you for real?
So I want to go back for a sec, because I think you touched on a really important point for people who are either in a job that they may not like or who are looking to re-enter the workforce. And you said the first step is to first figure out what your skill sets are. So one, how could someone do that? If you have any tips on actually helping someone identify what their skill sets are, and then what do you do from there? If you were to walk someone from beginning to, okay, new career or new path or getting them further on their journey, what would that path look like for somebody who's interested in starting something new?
I actually get this question a lot, and I will sit down and I help, and I'll try and send people to that direction. 90% of the time, you sometimes get people who are very, very self-directed and they know inherently what their skill and passion is. But in general, because we look at ourselves in the mirror so much, we don't give ourselves credit for having the talent that we have and the skill set that we have. So I'll recommend, whether it's a teen or an adult, I'll say, what would your best friend say? Or what would you do all day if you didn't have to go to school or you didn't have to go to work? I would take kids, you know, I'd be working on projects and say, well, what's your talent? And a kid would say, oh, nothing. And it can't be nothing. Are you that boring? You just sit there alone like a lump and nobody ever talks to you? You can't. I see that you have friends. What, you must have something good about you, at least one little thing. No. I said, well, I want you to report back to me in 5 minutes or less. You summon up your friend, and they'd all be in different classes. And thanks to class cutting and hallway passes and all those things. I'm like, okay, what can this person do? And their best friends would tell them, oh, she's so nice, or he does this, or she's great with animals, or whatever the talent. They'd come up with a laundry list of things. So if you don't know what your talents or skills are or what you're good at, you ask your friends and they'll say, oh my God, I couldn't organize anything, or she's so talented, or she does all these things. Then you build off of that skill set. And then you say, well, where do I want to go with that? And for me, now that I'm doing this more intentionally, before it was all passion and a bunch of squirrel projects. But now that I know where I'm going, because every project has led to something else, I've pretty much figured out that a lot of the bad behaviors that I was doing financially, like hoarding and couponing, and that all led to, I'm going to grow my own food and homesteading and things. I realized that even though I'm talking about budgeting and talking about helping teachers or my story and how I had to really think about my own financial interactions with my job, now that I'm thinking about that intentionally, I realize, well, I'm still canning, I'm still growing, I'm still brewing, I'm still culturing and doing these things. Oh my goodness, something that was fear and something that started as a negative is really my passion, my interior love. I want to talk to you about raising chickens. I want to talk to you about making your own kombucha. And before I started, because I'm not paying $4 a bottle for kombucha, I can make this. But now all these things turned into passions and I can direct that in another way. So for me, I had my first blog, which was just a blog where I wrote. Then I started the Broke Teacher page as a joke and wrote that book because it was the next step in where I was going and what I was thinking about. But through that project, I ended up realizing these cheap things, you can do them eloquently, cut out the waste, really have money to live well, and then live naturally. I started thinking, and just my mind was spinning, I can buy something nice because I didn't waste money on that, or I can grow my own food, or I have the power to do things myself if I want. And that became a project I started to jokingly call the Poser Homestead, because I kill a lot of what I grow. But the point is if you're maybe six months ahead of where you want to be, you're learning what you're going to learn next. You're learning what you're passionate about now. And all that stuff will eventually manifest into adding into some of your skills that people will know you for.
I think that's really awesome. I think that it's really important to know is that no matter where you are or where in life you are or the position you're in, that there's always a way out. And it's just taking baby steps to first assess where you're at, what you like, what you enjoy, what you're passionate about, where you naturally gravitate towards, then figuring out where you want to go next. And then I think the final step is eventually, once you know and continue doing things that you enjoy doing, is then comes the question of, how do I monetize this? How do I make this so that as much as I love it doing this, because oftentimes I will say too, I hear people who are like, I just want to do what I'm passionate about, but then they feel guilty for monetizing what they're passionate about because it's like, oh, well, if I'm passionate about it, I don't need the money to do it.
And that's really key. And that's something that, again, all my websites and all the things that I've written, I've done that out of the heart because it was speaking to me and I did it. The Broke Teacher site, for example, started as a hobby site. And then I wanted to make it less ugly. So I started learning more Adobe, more design, and it's still pretty darn ugly. I'm not going to lie. But then I got to finish the section today because I was doing a lot of menu planning and meal planning. I put it on that site. And I thought, oh my goodness, I have never taken a dollar from that site. And so I thought to myself, well, how could I do that? And I make, I send a lot of bracelets that I make for fun. I said, you know, maybe I'll just put those on a store page and you can pay me. It could be as simple as me putting that bracelet up there and saying, you can just PayPal me the money and I'll send it to you. Or I can hang a shingle on that, which I haven't done and I've thought about, and you're probably inspiring me to actually do it. I will sit and I'll help people do their LinkedIn portfolios or do these things. To me, are just self-evidently, like if you're going to go out and look for a job or develop your skills, you should have all your social media in order. But a lot of people don't think about it in the same way. So I consulted with and helped a lot of people. So if I were to do that and say, well, for $50, I'll help you shore up your social media. Just to take that first dollar, you're not going to feel like a $10 million consultant coming out of the gates if you're not comfortable asking for money. And I certainly have always had asking for money be my Achilles heel. So how could I just take $1 today or $10 tomorrow? Or what could I do? And it's interesting. I have a student, he's in marketing now, and he wrote a book. His name is Andy Audate. And he came back and he spoke to my classes. And he told this story one day. And I thought, oh, man, I love you. I'm so proud. He said, somebody wanted him to work on a project. And he was about to say, yeah, I'll do that for $250 because it was a few hours and it was within his area of expertise. And instead, he mentally stopped and he said, well, wait a minute, that's undervaluing my value. I'm going to ask for $5,000. He said, that would be great. In order to get started working with me, it will be $5,000 and we can do X, Y, and Z, whatever his process was. And they said, okay. And going from the jump mentally in your mind from intending to ask for $250 and he asked for $5,000 and they said, okay, yeah, sure. I've had that experience too. I've worked with people who nickel and dimed me. I've worked with people who had said, hey, can you look at this and do it? And I realized that was a consulting job and I just ended up doing all your work and you're going to get paid, but I didn't get anything. You're in these spots, but I've also been in positions where I just held my breath and I said, here's my rates. And people said, okay. And they sent me the money or they sent me a check. And so what's the worst thing? If I say, hey, Jen, yeah, I'll do that for you, or I'll set up all your social media. And what, you seem to spend a lot of money on your classroom. Let me restructure that for you. And it'll be $200 for the year. And for that, you can call me and I'm going to, give you this amazing pep talk or whatever that you think is a good value for your service and good for your customer, win-win. If I charged you $200 and I was available to you and I said, you're not going to buy those pencils, Jen. And you like, right. And when we had this relationship and I just like an AA person, I got you out of that spending addiction. Chances are teachers spend thousands. So if I stopped you from spending $1,000, is it valuable for you to give me $100 or $200 or $300? Absolutely. But what we're not doing is we're not putting ourselves in the mindset to feel like we have that value to give. And so again, this is always a struggle for me. So I empathize with anybody who's switching careers who thinks that their value isn't quite there yet. I would maintain it's there if you can identify it and figure out who the right person to ask is. And we all have to work on that road together.
I agree 100%. I think though what's really important too is once you identify what your value is, if you can figure out how much it would be worth to somebody else and how much you can save them or how much you can help them increase their revenue. So if let's say you could save someone $10,000 a year, if you charge $2,000, that's nothing. Or if you could help someone generate an extra $10,000 for their business and you say your fee is $1,000 a month, that is more than fair. And I speak out of for me personally too, think that, oh, I can tell someone I'm worth $1,000 for XYZ, whatever that might be. It's really hard. And so I just think it's really important though, that people consciously make these decisions and consciously think about this on what value do I have? And realistically, how much can I save or how much can I increase someone else's worth that I deserve a piece of that?
And one thing that's really been helpful to me and is this, I realized something. I've done a lot of projects with friends with marketing projects or helping with the outreach or putting their stuff out there and doing these things. And so two things. One, I know a lot about a lot of things, but I sometimes feel I've never finished to expert level with any one thing. So for example, I started learning things like Facebook ads and never really needed them. So I didn't put them out for myself. So I didn't convert these things for myself. I do grassroots marketing. If you gave me something to promote, I'd say sure and share it with the world. But how well did I promote my own stuff? Mm. So knowing that we would do anything for anyone around us and we would help and do that for free, we could take that, we could flip the language and say, well, what if I were doing this for name whoever you would do anything for free? What if I was doing this for my job? Or what if I was doing this for my best friend? I would go crazy to promote this or do this or sell this. So a lot of what I try to do now is say, well, what? I hold myself accountable by saying, well, if this was for work, it would be done by now. Why isn't my stuff done by now? Yes. And so I'm not much for accountability circle. I don't like to have little writer circles, but having a friend or two on the journey saying, hey, what did you make? I have a friend, her name is Alicia Sullivan, and she's got a Teachers Pay Teachers site, and she built it well. Her stuff is solid. And I fully expect that her stuff will go off Teachers Pay Teachers, and she'll have a full store, a full consulting gig. She's done consulting in the past. But we'll get together, and we have coffee once or twice a month, and we say, hey, this week I want to put my store up, or this week I want to fix my this page or this landing page or this offer. So whatever it is, it's not like, hey, what do you think about this? It's like, I'm doing this, you're doing this, and let's just drink coffee. So you have people, not that you're accountable to because you can't do it yourself, but you have people to inspire you because they're already on the road that you're on. And you're also saying, I have ideas all the time. And she'll say to me, shiny object. Like, yeah, you're right. It seems to me to be very related to my project, what I'm doing, but really what it is it's a detour and I'm procrastinating and not doing what I need to do with my own marketing or writing or book. So having those people around is amazing. Recognizing your skills is amazing. And then having some lines memorized. After a while, there comes a point when you're working in freelancing and you want to take advantage of making money or being compensated for your value. You want to transition out of, sure, I'll help with that, to the next level, but you don't really know what your value is yet. You don't know how to price it. You don't know what people in your space are willing to pay. So what you have to do is, and you feel guilty. So for me, I had to memorize some lines.
Yes, that's so important. Having lines already at your tip of your tongue is so helpful. It takes away the stutter. It takes away the, how do I respond? And it just makes you feel more confident and more assured of yourself. And you know what you're saying. What are some of the lines that you use?
Sure. Here are my rates. Or I even remember walking into my boss at school and saying something like, you may wonder why I haven't done all these things lately. I used to write a lot of curricula. I did all these things and I found people weren't using them. So I'm no longer willing to spin my wheels. At the time, I was trying to do some marketing for the school and my boss had originally said, yeah, and I put articles in national publications. I had students writing for really prominent editors and things. So I did all these things to get some marketing out there. And I came up with some resistance down the road. And I said, here's the deal. I'm no longer willing to do things for free. This I'll do for free because I feel passionate about school. But when I do, it's my choice. You need to get out of my way. Here's how much I would make doing this outside of here. And so you have to realize, what's the opportunity? If I'm on 8 committees doing all these things for free, then I'm not giving myself time to do these other things. And then when these other things do present themselves, then you have to pick them off and say, oh my goodness, they're about to ask me to do something. So then you say, oh my goodness, I'm really interested in that. That sounds great. If you want to send me a quick email with some bullets, I'll be able to go over my rates and put something together for you if you want me to work on that with you.
Love that so much. And as you're talking, I'm realizing too that I think one of the other issues is that there's a switch in a mindset between an employee mindset to a business owner mindset. Because oftentimes as an employee mindset, if your boss or your superior tells you what to do, you do it automatically. But if it's for you, for your own business, it's almost a back burner. It's not as important. But I think having also just these one-liners of, oh, let me get back to you. I'll tell you my rates, or, oh, this is how much I typically charge for something like that. Just having those almost embedded in your talk, in your conversational pieces, it's such an awesome way that I think will help people feel comfortable than asking for that next level of once they identify what their offer is and what their value is, how do you then actually take it to the monetization phase?
Well, and that's really key. And I've had to practice those lines and really reinforce them because I think it's important because you have to reframe your mindset. And I have to certainly reframe my mindset after decades of really having those loops be set in my brain. And my friend that I recommended his book earlier, his first book was Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends on It. And it's just, he's rewriting it now and expanding it, but it talks about those mental loops. The words are important and reprogramming is important. And for me, that has been a large challenge. What I do is I have to stop and pause. And when you stop and pause, they're about to ask you something and you stop and pause, you probably pause for about half a second, but it feels like 45 minutes. But if you stop, pause, and breathe, and you reset it, great. I'll have to shift a couple projects. I can do that. If it's a priority for you, I can discuss rates. Or I have some really great ideas for that. Probably take me a weekend to do those. Did you want to book that time with me? If you discuss rates, book, then you're doing that. But you almost, if you feel it's painful to ask or do, then it's an acting job. If you've ever done any stand-up improv, acting, school theater, even younger, you say, okay, then this is my script. And how do I say this particular thing? How do I have it always ready so I'm ready to go back to that script? And the worst thing that they can do is say no. And I've had people say no. I've had people say yes and then say, well, I didn't realize you were going to charge me this. I did somebody's websites. I did 2 or 3 websites for them, charged them $300, which is free, basically.
Yeah.
And then the person said, well, wait a minute, I didn't know you were going to charge me that. I said, well, I gave you the friends and family rate. Here was the hourly rate. Here was what I did here. And I did extra. I didn't even charge you for these things. So sometimes you have to cut a client loose or say, well, this isn't a productive use of my time, or we're not on the same page, or I can finish this up for you, but it's going to take me an extra 8 hours. Is that okay with you?
Before we jump into the next segment of the show, Lightning Round, I'd really like to summarize because I think we pulled out a lot of really awesome key points. So first off, for someone who's looking to figure out what the next step of their life is or to figure out how they can monetize some of their value, so the first thing to do is identify their skill sets, identify what they're passionate about, speak to friends, family members, find out what they're really good at and enjoy. So that's step one. Then the step two is to, okay, now that I know what I really like to do and I really enjoy it, if I were to do this to, for somebody else, how much would other people charge? And maybe do a little bit of research or speak with others, find people who are already doing that, figure out how to connect with them, then start asking them some questions. They don't have to be tons of questions, but just something so you can get, figure out what more specifically maybe they're doing and how much they're charging. And then I think the next step would be step three would be, now I know how much other people are charging. How much do I feel comfortable charging? Knowing now that, okay, if other people are able to charge this, why can't I charge this? Now I want to put myself into a business owner mindset, not get out of the employee mindset. So then once I identify what my rates would be, then step, I think, four is having a couple of conversational pieces available. And I know you talked on some of them, and I'd love to put them in the show notes as this is what my rates are, or this is how much I typically, let me check my schedule, I'll see what my booking availability is, or this is how much I typically charge. And then from there, it'll put someone in a much better place to actually start to create some extra income. Is there anything you would add or change along those lines?
No, I think that that's that. And again, I feel so grateful because for me, this was a gift. I would not be on this journey if it weren't for people like Kamal directing me. I wouldn't be writing. I wouldn't do any of these things. But what I found is this. You can connect with so many people. The internet's at your disposal. And many people out there will help you out. If you say, hey, I really loved your book. I loved what you did. How did you start? There was nobody I met who will say, go away, pound sand.
Yeah.
And even like I put that all this, I put it in a chapter in the Broke Teacher book because again, most people will throw tomatoes at that. Like, what do you mean? What do you can't do that. It must be easy for you. Well, it was no easier for me. I mean, I got up at 4 a.m. in the morning and I did my writing and then I went to school and taught and then I came back and I worked my job with in tech. So for me, I think the blessing for me was I was just so starved for something to really activate my brain that I was so excited. But the magic was that when the opportunities came, I said yes. And I didn't realize that was magic for a long time until I kept meeting people who over and over would tell me they were in difficult situations and they'd say, oh, I wish I could do what you're doing, or I wish I could make money writing, or I wish I could do these things. And so naturally I wanted to help. So when I met people who I thought that they would be a great connection for, I'd say, hey, I met this person. They're looking for a writer doing this. It will be great for you. Want me to introduce you? Oh, well, I can't. Or when my son is in kindergarten, well, my son was little too. So I found that people didn't always want to do these things. They didn't want to always be independent because they, for whatever reason, whether they were afraid, whether they didn't think they could do it. So the key is to say yes. And even talking about going from the employee mindset to the business owner mindset, I struggle with even those words because as a former business owner who has put businesses to bed painfully, I never wanted businesses. I was afraid of the independence. I was afraid of, oh my God, these employees are depending on my decision here today. And what I say is that's their livelihood. And even while I was teaching and we had these businesses, it was a responsibility. And you see the best startup CEOs, the best teams, they're out there looking out for their teams and they're building and they're doing these things. And so for me, I didn't want a business.
You know, Dawn, thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate your perspective. I never thought about it like that. And I know myself, I always thought I have to gather out race. You have to gather 9 to 5, start a business is the way to go, doing something that you love and you're passionate about. But I think what you're touching on is almost like what the Rich Dad, Poor Dad book about, you know, there's four cash flow quadrants. I don't know if you've read that, but the cash flow quadrant, there's the employee, there's self-employed, there's business owner, and there's investor. And you want to get to the business owner investor side where you're cash flowing. But even from the business owner standpoint, you can eliminate yourself from the equation and it still becomes a passive business. But if you're worrying about the day-to-day and you're stressed, it may not be something that you actually want to do. So I can really appreciate for people who may love their job and may want to continue working in their field or their profession or don't want to have a big business or want to continue working where they're doing or they just want to continue creating passive income but not have the headache attached to it. And so I think it's a good reminder. And I really appreciate that thought because it's just like you're running forward. But is that you're running forward towards a business to this ideal, to this thing that you're supposed to do, you're supposed to achieve, but is that really what you want? And I think that's a good caution for people to don't be a business owner just because it's cool or because you feel you need to be a business owner to get out of the rat race. There's other ways to get out of the rat race, but continue to follow your passion, follow what makes sense to you, and don't just take on another job or something that's going to cause you stress and anxiety. If you have employees that are dependent on you, and if you don't make money, then they don't feed their families. Yeah, that can be a huge headache. I totally get that. Before we transition into the lightning round, are there any other lessons or tips that you can share for those who are considering making a transition into something else, maybe leaving their job, starting a business, or following whatever is inspiring them or whatever their passion might be?
So the lesson that I didn't understand for another 5 years was, well, who is your audience and are you building for them? And I've worked with people who are building these things and I wouldn't use that. Just some companies that I've run across and said, well, I don't need that or that doesn't work for me. And if you're not, you may think that you're building for one person and you're building for somebody else. So if you're a mom and you think that you're a good photographer, well, no, you've put on the best large scale events that I've ever seen, or look at your website. It's hilarious. You could totally fix schools in your area, whatever your talent is. You have to ask and you have to say, is this resonating with you? Or how do I connect with this? Or how do I make this work for you? I once built something and I asked a friend to test it out. And he said, oh, it doesn't work on my phone. I said, well, did you upgrade your phone? Is it? And he went nuts. He was a tech guy. And he said, that's not how this works. You never put your problems off on your user. That's the sure way you're going to die. And to this day, that's one of the top 2-3 lessons I've learned. Is this my problem? Am I pushing it off on you? Is this something you even want? So when I'm writing, does this have value to you? I can sit here and write a diary all day long, but if it doesn't have value to you, I didn't do the world any good. So that's something I'm totally always running through and always looking at in myself. Does it have value to you? Did I execute right? Did I ask for my value? And these are not easy questions. And it's a journey that I will always improve. I think that the background being a teacher, it's something that never goes away, that challenge. And maybe one day it does. And I feel totally confident and I'm putting my stuff out like Amy Porterfield and Marie Forleo. And you're like, yeah, I feel good. You can pay me 10 grand right now and I'm happy and we're all happy and the world is good. I don't think that was an easy journey for any of those entrepreneurs in the beginning too, based on my knowledge. So you just progress every day. You ask for your value. And if you can't ask for your value, that's your struggle. You memorize the lines and it's Hollywood. Take yourself out of the equation and here's my shtick, here's my act. My script is this and I'm going to produce.
Dawn, I think that you're 100% spot on. I think that's really fantastic. Thank you so much. At this point in the show, I'd like to transition to our famous lightning round. These are awesome. Going to be the same 4 questions that I ask all my guests. Question number 1 is, what is one fun fact about you that not many people know?
Oh, just one. Okay. So I was thinking about this the other day. I applied for MTV's Real World. I think it was season 2 and wherever, way toward the beginning when reality TV was much different. So that was one. Another awesome. One was in college. I wanted to be a competition weightlifter. It didn't work out because I'm a skinny vegetarian. And then the third one was I really did want to be a professional musician. And I just was tossed off the steps of the Eastman School of Music. I didn't get into Eastman through the proper channels, but I realized that if you went to Rochester through an academic scholarship and you took all these classes, you get all these grad students and you'd like be there with these people who love Mozart as much as you. And yeah, it didn't work out. I was untrained, unworthy. So yes, those are a few facts that I apologize to all of Eastman. Every musician in the entire classical world. I'm so sorry.
Those are great. Question number 2, who inspires you the most and why?
Oh, that's a tough one. There are so many people out there just doing amazing things. I know that when I was teaching, I would have told you my students, which sounds like a canned answer, but I've got kids out there building their companies and doing their things. I am most grateful to my friend for starting me on this journey, to my friend Kamal. That's a space of gratitude. But inspiring wise, I think everybody that I look at, I want to look at what's the quality in them that makes them so great that I want to take that one kernel from them. And I just think that so many people have that quality that if you stop and look and learn from everybody, that you can be equally inspired by people. So every conversation, feel inspiration walking away from normal people like me.
That's awesome. Well, and question number three, what book are you reading now or have you read that you'd recommend to others?
Right now, I'm reading a whole bunch of, I'm reading down the catalog of Chigra Devakaruni because she's just, I rarely read fiction. I should read far more fiction than now. I'm always reading something to help or do or make me a little bit better. And so I'm reading that. I read a lot of food books too and food history books. I love them. I've got some homesteading books on my stuff. I could totally go off all day with different categories of books that I've loved. But yeah, those are a few. I feel now my Kindle gives me permission to ADHD through my reading. I don't have to finish reading everything.
Before we actually go on to the next question, I want to ask, because you are an author yourself of A Broke Teacher's Guide to Success. How can people get access to it?
So my books are on Amazon. My first book was pretty much education reform across the board. It was Don't Sniff the Glue, A Teacher's Misadventures in Education Reform. And then the second one, A Broke Teacher's Guide to Success, they are both available on Amazon, and you can definitely download the Kindle or get the paperback.
Great. And I'll put in the show notes too, links to both books. Thank you. And the fourth and final question is, what is one actionable tip or piece of advice that you can tell our moms out there to help them on their own path to financial independence?
I think that might be one of my favorite questions, because I think the answer to that, and I was speaking with somebody recently who just felt overwhelmed with the journey and doing it. This person was doing some consulting and there's a lot going on, but you have to just do it. And that's a little bit almost disingenuous for me to say, because I don't think I would be writing or doing half the things that I've had just the good fortune and blessing to be able to do. If I had known the significance of the spaces that they were setting me up, I think teachers, we apologize a lot for things. We put ourselves to the side. And I think moms are also used to, our food is cold, we help everybody. Where's the sugar? Well, you could just as easily look for it as me. So we're used to jumping and doing and assisting other people. So what I would say is carve out that time for you. Make it a date with yourself, even a commitment. If you want to be a writer, then there's nothing stopping you from being a writer. You need to write. And for me, I got up at 4 a.m. I wrote from 4 to 6. I'd go to school, I'd teach all day, then I'd come back and I'd work my jobs that I was working at the time. So when people would say, I wish I could do what you do, you can. So whatever you want to do, if you want a new career, if you want to just freelance on the side, if you want to improve in some skill, then you need to do it. And you need to do it every day without looking at the scale, looking at the barometer, looking at your progress. Because in 3, 4, 5, 6 months, you'll be able to look back and feel a totally different person. That's my experience. I've learned my last few endeavors and careers by having smart friends, following smart friends, cutting out the things that weren't productive, things that weren't helpful, people that weren't helpful, and just putting myself in a circle of people who really wanted to do great things. And in the beginning, I didn't know that that was a circle I was in. I just said, wow, this is really cool. Sure, I'll help you. I'll do this. I'll do that. But that turns out to be the secret. The secret is, if you want to learn something, go learn it and then try it. And maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't. I mean, I've got a whole bunch of ugly websites out there and I keep trying to make them prettier. And you keep doing it. And then you say, well, wait a minute. If I want to do this for real, how do I do that? So for me, writing, I put it out there for real. Then what would the next step be? Well, if I want this to be my job, how would I get somebody to pay me for this? Or how would I take a dollar on that website? Or how would I consult and not have it be a favor? So you just, every time you do something, you take that one step to get to the next thing, but you take a step every single day.
That's great advice. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for coming on today's episode. You were a chock full of nuggets. And I think a lot of not just teachers, but I think is going to find your information and all of your tips very helpful. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Jen. I appreciate it. This has been excellent speaking with you today.
Awesome. Well, how can other moms connect with you if they want to learn more about your work or what you have going on or reach out to you?
I'm on Twitter and I'm at @runningdmc, also Instagram. I've been doing a lot more Instagram lately because I really like pretty pictures. So that's an art space for me. But I've been able to strike up some conversations in both spaces. I do education Twitter, and I also have, my email is dawn@broketeacher.com, and there's the Broke Teacher website if anyone's interested in these topics. So I'm out there and you can find me, and I'd be happy to connect with people. I'd love to make some new connections out there.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, and I look forward to reconnecting soon.
Excellent.
All right. That wraps up another amazing episode. I hope you found a lot of value. I sure learned a lot, and I hope you were taking notes because it was pretty awesome. A lot of the information that I did put in the show notes. So don't worry if you didn't get everything, definitely go check them out. If you do like the Investor Mama podcast so far, please subscribe and please leave a review. It really helps let the providers know that you are finding value from the content that I am providing. So please subscribe, please leave a review. And if you are really ambitious, leave a written review, even a one-liner, I'd really appreciate it. And I will put a link to that in the show notes. Also, if you have not joined the Investor Mama tribe, please go to investormama.com/connect. Here you can join the Facebook group or follow me on Instagram. But in the Facebook group specifically, I'm really trying to create a community. So for those of you who have any wins, any questions or comments, anything you like, share there on our next community corner. I will share it, which I'm really excited about. If you haven't listened to last week's Community Corner episode, check it out. It's all great stuff. So stay tuned for another great episode being released next Thursday. And this is Investor Mama. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Investor Mama podcast. If you like today's episode, please support us by clicking subscribe on the platform you are currently listening to, leaving a comment or awesome review, and spreading the wealth and sharing this podcast with friends and family or on social media. Don't forget to check out investormama.com to connect with our community and sign up for our email. Stay tuned for next week's episode.